How was he, like, late 50s, early 60s?
He was,
younger than that.
Welcome, everybody. I call the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation to order. Today is Wednesday, April 6, 2011. Before we get started with member introductions and the agenda, we're going to adopt committee rules and some other things. But even before any of that, we're going to immediately start off by not following the agenda. And since we have a very important guest here today, I'm going to take the opportunity to invite the Honorable Governor John Kitzhaber to say a few words and get us started on the right path. Governor?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. I appreciate very much the opportunity to take a very brief bit of your time this evening and give you a little bit of an overview of certainly what I'm hoping will come out of this this important special committee. I think that you are posed to have a profound impact on the delivery of health care, not only here in Oregon, but I also think at the national level. As you know, we have a huge hole in the Oregon Health Authority budget in the neighborhood of 39%. We don't have a secret pot of money rat-holed away somewhere to address that. And I think that without taking some action, that's the cut level we're looking at. Clearly, we have had some discussions in your Transformation Committee about getting that down to around a 19% level, assuming we make some significant changes in the delivery system in the second year or later in the biennium. We all know that most of the costs in the healthcare system can be attributed to people with chronic illnesses, and we know that around 10% of the population drives 70% of the costs. So I think the strategy here clearly is to try to focus a delivery system change where most of the money is, chronic conditions, and where most of the waste and inefficiency is, the lack of coordination and the lack of integration. I know that time is short. I know that we've got till the middle of, I don't know what the magic number is in the Senate President's mind, but the middle of May to get some product out of here, and I would hope that you would consider at least this framework. First of all, developing a new delivery model that reflects five what I think are very key elements. One of them is defining the population, which in this case would be 500,000 people on Medicaid as well as the dual and triple eligibles. Secondly, that we coordinate and integrate the delivery of mental health, chemical and chemical dependency, physical health, long-term care, and dental health. Third, that we use a global budget, that we set fixed budget levels that are sufficient to achieve our objectives and provide some incentives for prevention and wellness, and harness in the unsustainable growth of healthcare costs, at least for this population, and some ability to drive innovation through changing the way we pay. A fourth, local accountability, creating a framework within which local community-based health entities can assume responsibility for costs and outcomes. And finally, a framework for establishing measurable outcomes and results. Secondly, I know that you can't get all that done in great detail between now and the middle of May, so I would hope you would consider creating a framework and a process that would then allow us to flesh out the details of that over the next few months, and then some check-off, whether that's the e-board or whether we come in for a day to adopt something, to give you the ability to look at the product and say, yes, this is good enough to go and allow us to begin to implement that. And I think we can get that done between now and September once you create that framework and set that process process in motion. Let me just close with one anecdote. I was at the National Governors Association meeting in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, and we had a meeting with the president in the White House, all of us governors, and after the press left and the door shut, there was the most candid conversation I've ever heard about our healthcare system. And it was all about the cost of Medicaid and Medicare, which everyone recognizes what's driving the national debt. And what became very, very clear to me is that the United States Congress is going to do something about the costs of Medicare and Medicaid. And I believe they're going to be doing it in a budgetary context with not a lot of consideration about what it means for the delivery of health care, including health of Americans. It's going to be about reducing the national debt. So I think we have an opportunity to be architects here in this state of what that new delivery model looks like, or we can be victims of the budget balancing frenzy that's going to assume large and partisan proportions in our nation's capital. So that is the reason I started my comments by saying I think you have a profound impact to really lead the way for how a rational, cost-effective, quality healthcare system should work here in Oregon, but also at the national level. Thank you very, very much for the hard work you're doing, and I appreciate the chance to appear before you this evening.
Thank you, Governor Hitzhopper, for getting us started on the right path. On behalf of the legislature, it's wonderful to have a governor that is going to work with us and partner with us to get this done, and we are going to put our heart and soul into it and see what we can come up with. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So,
speech, and then
we have to do all the work.
Yeah.
Back to the script. So, I will open an organizational meeting and ask the committee administrator to briefly summarize the proposed rules.
Thank you, chairs, co-chairs, and chairs. A copy of what was sent out to you earlier, and there's a copy in front of you. I'll just summarize quickly the points. This is comprised of members of both chambers, co-chairs, and Senate co-chair. And for anything to the majority is of the body is a majority of each chamber, so any substantive work such as passing a bill out of committee, making recommendations, has to be a quorum of both chambers in a vote. The co-chairs do have the ability to set all the agendas, time, place of meeting. There has to be a notice for any kind of a hearing. In the event that something needs to be carried over, the chairs do have to agree to carry a bill over. It has to be the same type of bill that comes out of the committee that's originally posted. You are allowed to carry over in work sessions bills that you're waiting on for fiscals and revenues that sometimes happens. You are allowed to limit testimony. Again, for an affirmative vote of a majority of each chamber, is required to do any of the following: table a measure, to introduce bills, to amend, to pass a bill to the floor. You can request a roll call vote with two members. This joint committee cannot, when a bill goes to the floor, it cannot be accompanied with a minority report. And that's probably the main parts of the bill. You do have to adhere to the Senate and House rules. In this case, if there's a first public hearing, the House rule takes precedence. Has to be a 72-hour posting notice on that. That's probably the biggest difference of the two chambers. And with that, I will stop unless there's any questions.
Yes, I have a question. I know how the exchange worked and how we worked the amendments. And this Rule 15 says that proposed amendments by other than members of the Legislative Assembly must be submitted in writing to committee staff. And we as chairs have not decided how we are going to handle amendments. So will that make a difference if the chairs decide to do amendments like having them all come to you and we just will that affect
no
the
I
chair?
You can suspend rules here or modify these rules whenever possible. I don't believe that would affect in terms of amendments kind of funneling through me. If that's what you decide as a committee, as the chairs, basically this is just applies to amendments that come directly to the committee as a whole. If I collect them, I think we can get around that since they're not coming directly to the committee. I will check, though, with the parliamentarians in both chambers to make sure that's not a problem.
I assume no amendment gets on the table here unless it's proposed on the table by one of the members of the committee. There isn't any other way for an amendment to get on the table, is there?
I think this is referring to amendments by people other than the members of the Assembly.
No, I understand. I'm not even talking about other members of the Assembly. I mean, it seems to me there's only one way for an amendment to get before this committee, and that's have it moved by one of the members of the committee. So, I mean, there isn't any compulsion to take any other amendments from anybody.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
I believe this was some standard language that was part of some
Fine.
Joint committees we've had in the past in our Ways and Means process. Is there any other questions?
Well,
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I understand what Representative Greenick's talking about, but I'm not sure I necessarily want to preclude input from another member of the Legislative Assembly that's not on this committee. So,
I think these individuals have any right to do whatever we want to do, but it seems to me the only way an amendment can get before any committee formally is to be proposed by a member of the committee, to be moved by a member of the committee.
A note to mother.
Isn't that right?
Takes a note to mother.
I believe it takes a motion of a committee member while we're running the meeting, so I think that's the... I think that's correct.
I understand, but what I was talking about was if we're funneling amendments through the committee staff, which I think is the appropriate thing to do, and let's say another senator not on this committee had an amendment and wrote a note to mother to somebody, wouldn't that automatically go to committee staff, or would it at that point have to come to us and then to committee staff? I mean, I would assume it would just go to...
The rule allows it to go to the committee administrator. Right. That's what the rule states. So, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't know if this is a rule change per se, but this idea that other members, people other than legislators, could propose amendments, bring them in, get them to committee administrator. I know that's what that's normal practice, and I wouldn't want to pull back from that too much because I think we want transparency. However, we're on a very tight timeline. I mean, I would hope the expectation of this committee would be if there are amendments, that there are champions for a particular amendment on this committee or a legislative member who's going to actually champion them. I think it's going to be really important for people to prioritize these amendments in a way, because if we have too much of a free-for-all, we're never going to get done. So I don't know how we capture that, but... is there a way for us to say, yeah, we can take all the amendments we want, but I think there has to be a commitment from the members of this committee that we will champion those amendments, because if we have endless hours of conversation, just for the sake of conversation, we will not get done. So I don't know how we do that. Thank you.
I think this is a very important point. And I think the standard practice in this legislature is that amendments come to a committee through a member of the committee. And I think the last thing we want is 100-odd amendments dropping on us, as has happened in other processes that are unfiltered. And it seems to me, if there are members of this committee that want to propose amendments on the floor, put amendments on the floor, then that's how they get put on the floor. I don't think there's any other way to get them on the floor.
Do you suppose maybe our chief clerk might have an opinion of this? Do you mind? We'll take questions. Would you like to comment, please, Ramona?
Good evening. My name is Ramona Kennedy Line, and I'm the chief clerk for the Oregon House. I appreciate the conversation. These rules are no different than any of the other committee rules that are before you in any of your other committees and or joint committees. And basically, the rule is to provide that if an outside entity wants to propose or bring into that process an amendment, they need to have that to committee staff 48 hours in advance. However, none of those amendments will be considered unless one of the members champions that amendment and wants to push it forward as a dash set of amendments. No one else can bring those amendments forward. But this gives an opportunity, and as you all are aware, both in the House and Senate, all amendments have to come through Legislative Council. Council does not draft amendments for any outside entity. It has to have been an amendment that is proposed by a member of the House or the Senate. So basically, that is your filter. If some other member than this committee wants to bring an amendment for you to consider, they probably would have that prerogative to bring that to the committee staff 48 hours in advance, so that there then the co-chairs and the committee might take those under consideration. But there is plenty of sort of filters in place to protect you from a slew of amendments coming at you unintended and without you knowing in advance about those amendments.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the subcommittee that we processed the exchange bill, we used a little different process. We invited conceptual amendments from the stakeholders, and we will have many, many stakeholders in this process to be funneled through the committee administrator. And then those conceptual amendments were looked at in the context of the whole and the sections and what fit together and what didn't fit. And then from that arose the specific concept for the amendments, rather than having a note to mother from a legislator to a stakeholder and a lot of things floating around. We were able to get that bill out. We had quick turnarounds. We had a meeting on Wednesday or Thursday. We had quick deadlines to get the conceptual amendments in, reviewed them the next Monday, and had them to legislative council in time to draft for the next week's meeting. That process didn't work. Now, whether everyone was happy in that process, I don't know. Probably not. But it was a process that did function fairly well.
And thank you. And my guess is that happened under these rules, if all the rules are the same in all the committees. And the other thing these rules allow us to do, if there is a change that needs to be done, we can change them. So we can talk about this more tonight, or we can talk about changing them. But I'm happy to do whatever, because I want it very much to be an open process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I'm not impressed that model worked at all well. And I don't think it's the right process. I think we need to be working as a committee. We need to be working in public. We need to be having whatever comes before us in work session on specific amendments. And I think we need to be dealing with them, not behind closed doors with a subgroup of us making decisions, but on the record. So I very much think that's not a model we should do. I think we ought to be processing a bill, and I think we ought to be having amendments come to us in a regular way through LC and be dealt with on the record in open session.
Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated April 6, 2011.
There you go.
All right, we have Ms. Anderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated April 6, 2011. Is there any more discussion? Seeing none, is there anybody opposed? Seeing none. Do you want to do a roll? What are we okay on that?
I think just so moved.
Okay. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the rules of the committee having been settled, is the assumption that the co-chairs will be deciding on the process by which amendments will be handled?
My sense is there will be some further discussion about that particular issue.
Great. Glad to hear it. Thank you.
Fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. So I think what I'd like to do now is allow my fellow co-chairs to do a brief opening statement, introduce yourself, and then we'll have all the members introduce themselves. So, Senator?
Thank you, Chair Freeman. I'm delighted to be a part of a joint committee, and I think this is historic, what we are about to do. I think we are on the cutting edge in the nation, and I think we oppose. It started way back with 329. Senate Bill 329, and then 2009, and so this is just the next step, and delighted to be here. Thank you, and delighted to be working with the House, as well as the Senate.
Thank you. Chair Greenlee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee. That's House District 33 in Northwest Portland, and I also co-chair the Health Care Committee of the House, and I am very happy to be here to do this. I think I agree with Senator Miles Anderson. We have an historic opportunity. I think we ought to take the easiest path we can to get to a good outcome. And I'll have more to say about that, I think, when we have a chance to make statements later.
Thank you. So in an effort to extend an olive branch, we're going to start with the Senate side. So we'll start at the far end. If you'd please introduce yourselves and just a kind of a brief.
Sure. My name's Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon Senate, but my heart is always in the House. And and I've been involved in starting two organizations, one of which is my wife's primary care practice that sees a substantial amount of Medicaid patients, and I hope to bring some of that experience as well as my background helping people in recovery from addiction to this process, and I'm delighted to be here.
Senator Cruz.
We've met. Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Southwest Oregon, and my heart is in Southwest Oregon, God's country. Just simple country boy, kind of new to all this stuff, but I would remind my fellow committee members that this may be historic, but keep in mind so is Katrina. So we need to make sure that we go in the right direction. When you venture out, you have a chance of two outcomes, success or failure. We can't be afraid of failure, but we don't want to invite it.
Senator Bates, would you like to follow that?
On that positive note, family physician from Southern Oregon, about 35 years in practice, Senate for the last 10 years in the House. Combination. But on this trail since 1989, 1988, so this is the accumulation of 25 years of effort, 329, and then the health authority with Ben Westland. And it's I believe, a time that we're on the cusp of actually changing the system we've been trying to change for 30 years. I would caution us, though, that we only have 5 weeks to do this. 25 years condensed into 5 weeks. And if we start arguing about where we're sitting and the size of the table and what the rules are going to be, we're never going to get this job done. We only got 5 weeks to do it. We're going to hand something off to the Oregon Health Authority, essentially, apparently, from what our governor just told us. But I want some pretty tight sideboards on that, pretty clear picture of what we're trying to do. We need to do the things that have been talked about for 25 years. That's primary and preventative health care. That's coordinating health care. And that's global budgets for people who do not want global budgets. That's hospitals and doctors and other providers. We have some real stiff competition outside this room. And many of the people in this room are not going to like some of the things we're going to be talking about and some of the changes we think need to be made. If those changes aren't made, the system will collapse. And I believe we're within 10 to 15 years of that happening. So I'm looking forward to being here and doing some hard work the next 5 weeks. But remember, we've got to get it done. And it's got to get it done quickly with a handoff that's clean. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank Morris, District 8, the Albany-Corvallis area. I really don't have a whole lot to add other than the government model runs a little different than the business model. And I think this needs to be a focus on a business model more than a government model. And that is you create your mission, and that's been well crafted. I think the governor has done an excellent job of the broad statements. And you make your assumptions, and then you put those assumptions to work in a business plan. You do the pro formas, and you test, and you revise, and test, and revise. This is such a broad, sweeping change and transformation effort compressed in such a very short period of time, we run the risk of not getting it right. And that's a huge risk. And so I raised that issue not quite as artfully as the senator from Southwest Oregon. But we need to be thinking how this actually functions and do the pro formas and figure it out before we actually drop the hammer and say, let's go.
Very good. So we'll move to my far right with Representative Thompson.
Jim Thompson, House District 23, which is a long rural stretch of the West Valley, right up against part of Senator Morris's district. I think this is really an exciting opportunity. I wish we didn't have our back to the wall starting it. That would certainly help. But I started working on community-based chronic disease management plans in the mid-1990s, and we still haven't gotten it right here in Oregon. I think it's an opportunity to really transform organically the way we deliver health care, particularly to that population, save a lot of money and dramatically increase the outcomes and quality of life for the patients. So I'm hopeful that we can get all that cranked in and get the job done. And I'm not sure about the 5 weeks, 5 months maybe, but 5 weeks is pretty daunting.
Thank you. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, other one half of Senator Shields' district. It's good to see so many of the Wednesday night folks back for round two. missed you all. Ready to get started. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm Tim Freeman. I represent House District 2, which is Roseburg, south down I-5 to Wolf Creek, in the wonderful community of Weimar. I am privileged enough to represent State Senator Jeff Cruz. Of course, he's my senator, too. So that being said, I think we have a huge challenge in a short period of time. The combined expertise of the people in this room and those that are in Overflow D, which I was supposed to mention earlier, are going to help navigate us through this. So with that, I will close the organizational meeting and open an informational hearing on review and discussion of the healthcare transformation concept and call to the witness stand Dr. Goldberg, Mike Benetto, and Tina Hedlund. For the record, please introduce yourselves.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Benetto, Office of the Governor. Thank you for having us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tina Edlin. I'm the Chief of Policy with the Oregon Health Authority.
Well, thank you. I think, as Representative Kotek said, we'll just pick up where we left off a couple weeks ago and get back into our Wednesday routine. Before we get into this, I just wanted to have some context for what we're going to discuss tonight, because I think there's been some, maybe some confusion around the documents that are in front of us, and I think some people are kind of maybe jumping to conclusions around a legislative concept, and I just want to make sure we're clear. There's a document that you have in front of you listed preliminary discussion draft of OHA, the Oregon Health Authority legislative approach. And really what this is a compilation of all of this work from the health system transformation team and taking in that straw person model, taking in all of that input. And basically you can think about this as legislative framework, a rules framework for administrative rules, and potentially even some components of an RFP. I think the challenge really is now, from your perspective, of within this framework, what really needs to be included in statute. And I think I would say many would venture there's more in here that doesn't need to be here in statute. So I think what we wanted to do was kind of provide that framework of everything and then have you really kind of synthesize down. So, I mean, it's 18 pages. It's kind of this all that work of, 8 weeks of that transformation team. But now it's really getting down to what really needs to be in the statute. So with that, we're going to take a few minutes and kind of go through those kind of essential elements, talk a little bit about the time frame, and then be available for questions. Thanks.
Co-Chair Freeman, members of the committee, what we thought we would do now is, since this has had a lot of discussion over the last several weeks and has been available publicly, rather than to go through each and every section, we've picked out about six sections just to highlight very briefly as we walk through this. The first is Section 7, which really defines the essential elements for coordinated care organizations. And this lays out that coordinated care organizations are responsible for a full continuum of care for a defined population. Some of the elements that the governor laid out, that the coordinated care organization should have the capacity to deliver a full array of care and be accountable for the health, the finances, for the integration and coordination of that care. And that these be organizations that have a governance structure that really brings together the various pieces of our healthcare system in a local community. So to be able to bring together doctors, hospitals, nurses, yep, others who provide services within an area to work together rather than separately to figure out how to best provide services for a defined population, the Medicaid population. That's really the concept. It brings together multiple different providers, not necessarily in a single organization that they all work for, but brings these providers together in a coordinated effort to provide care for a defined population. And they do that within the next piece of this, which I'll spend a little bit more time on, which is Section 10, which is entitled Outcome-Based Payments. But what I wanted to just spend a few moments on, because it's been the topic of some discussion and I think bears a little bit more detail, is talking about a global budget and really what that is. And we've had some superficial discussions about it. Senator Bates mentioned a global budget in his comments. There's probably a lot of ways to budget globally, but let me put out a concept, which would be the following, that there'll be a budget for the Oregon Health Plan. There'll be a set amount of dollars that the legislature will make available to fund that. Likewise, there'll be a set number of people that we anticipate will be a part, will be eligible and will be in the Oregon Health Plan over the next 2 years. Let's say, for example, the budget's $100 and we would anticipate that there's going to be 10 people served in the Oregon Health Plan. We could, by doing that, create an amount for each person in the Oregon Health Plan. If there are $100 and 10 people, there would then be $10 per person. Organizations would then get that amount for every individual they served. Now, it's got to go a little deeper than that, because certainly the people that might be in a coordinated care organization in Roseburg might look differently than Portland or than Yamhill County or anywhere in the state. And so it's going to be important to adjust the risk of those populations. And there are ways that we do that now. We risk adjust between different managed care organizations in the Oregon Health Plan based on individuals' health status, their age, the diagnoses that they have. So it assures that although there's a set payment for each individual, that there is some equity in terms of we're not asking one organization to take care of some older individuals who have chronic disease and another for a number of healthy children, and have that be equitable in any way. And there's ways to adjust that. And then there's a third piece to that, which is and plans would take, these coordinated care organizations would take risk for that. They'd be responsible for delivering the services within that global budget. But the state takes some risk too. And where the state needs to take some risk is for enrollment. Because if indeed enrollment exceeds what we anticipated in that, it would not be fair to hold plans accountable for that. So in other words, to be able to say, if a plan were to take 100 individuals, and that's what we had anticipated, but then lo and behold, we continue to see enrollment grow in the Oregon Health Plan, and we had budgeted at the beginning of the legislation based on $500,000 and we end up with $600,000, and we had made that calculation based on the $500,000 number, I think that it would be incumbent upon the state to assume the risk for the additional dollars for additional people. And that is then how a global budget for an organization could work, with shared, in essence, risk. Then it would be up to the plan to consider how to make payments. And those payments could also be budgeted in a global fashion. A plan could provide a global payment to a hospital for the care of all of the individuals. They might provide a global payment to primary care providers to be able to do that. They might pay for outcomes. They might bundle payments. They might pay some things by a fee-for-service, some things based on a more global budget, based on a whole variety of ways, which would, I think, allow for the kind of innovation where these organizations could come together and use both the metrics, which you'll hear about, the outcomes that we'll expect from these organizations, as well as the dollars, to meet those in a way that made sense for the community. So what Section 10 does is really outline that these organizations will have a global budget and talks about some of the ways that plans could or couldn't decide, coordinated care organizations could or couldn't decide how, in essence, to pay the providers of service within that organization, understanding that hopefully these would be organizations that would bring together the various providers from a community to be able to have a discussion as well as with consumers about how to best use those resources to meet the health needs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to take us to Section 12, which is the section on metrics, which is one of the essential elements of making this all work and holding these organizations accountable is to have a really strong sense of set of metrics by which we hold them accountable. I think that in the Wednesday night group, the team identified over and over again, it came up in conversations pretty almost at every meeting how important the metrics discussion would be. What's been outlined here is that the metrics need to cover all the sectors that we're integrating in these organizations, so that there need to be metrics around physical health and behavioral health and dental health care and about efficiency. I mean, ultimately, they have to provide value and provide better care at a reasonable cost. I won't go into all what this section tries to do is actually just describe the areas that probably should be addressed in a good set of metrics. The team had suggested that we put together a group of outside experts to really work on this over the next several months in preparation for a request for proposals. So that's where the detail would be worked out. The section also talks about learning collaboratives that came up in the team discussions as well, that there should be an opportunity for organizations to learn best practices from each other. When someone finds something that really works and works well and develops a good outcome, that there should be a sharing of that information. And then that everything should be transparent, that consumers, in order to be able to take care of themselves and be responsible participants in their own health, have to have good, transparent information. I will go to then Section 17, which is also an essential part of what the team addressed on Wednesday nights. And this is coordinated care for people who are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. This is a small population. There are about 59,000 people in the state who are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. But they're complex. They're older and poor and ill, and they have complex cases, and they have high costs. So it's an area where we can really benefit from having careful coordination across the continuum of care. So the opportunity here to actually coordinate with Medicare and bring in the Medicare dollars and coordinate the spending of those dollars with Medicaid dollars is a significant opportunity as part of this effort. Then, Section 23. is that all of this will require some federal approvals. The full details we won't know until this process is over. But we do know some that in order to pay differently, we'll have to have some federal permission in order to do that. In order to actually do to integrate the care and align care for the Medicare and Medicaid dually eligible population, we will need special permissions from the federal government. To actually implement a global budget will also require some federal permissions. So work very closely with CMS. The staff at OHA will work very closely with CMS in order to address those issues and identify them as we go along. So,
Mr. Chair, committee members, the last thing we would just want to walk you through is the timeline. And this is something that we discussed several weeks ago, but just a few things that I would highlight this evening. As you look at that timeline, that top line where it says the legislature, I would just add the comments from Governor Kitzhaber this evening saying, you know, he is interested in understanding kind of what that sign-off or check-off procedure really needs to look like, and I think that's certainly something that we'd be interested in your deliberations. And as you look at that, trying to get some sort of legislation done by the end of June, the time frame of coming back for that checkoff and sign off before we'd be able to move forward. I think the catch and the acknowledgement needs to be that, you know, Bruce and the OHA would certainly need some direction, some authority to go out and really have some discussion with CMS for waiver approval that would require some form of legislation. So I think it's really understanding what those components need to be in order to move on that and then still being able to come back and have that checkoff. And certainly the other, as you look through that timeline, I think the other big thing that has been highlighted is just, you know, how soon can we go? And what is realistic? Certainly we have, from a budget perspective, having the CCO models, moving by, July of 2012, having a process that we have down here for early adopters, and how can that look as the same with an RFP process. So I think there's still, some details to be worked out, but I think we're really focused just on the immediacy of obviously getting a framework passed. And I think I've heard it from many of you just over the last, 15 minutes of 5 weeks, 5 weeks, 5 weeks, what can be done. And I think what we're trying to say is, how can we help, with that framework that can allow that work to then begin and then obviously come back for that sign-off and check-off.
Great. Well, thank you for that quick overview. Is there any questions from members? These folks kind of as a starting point. Co-Chair Greenlee.
Could you talk about one other document as well while you're doing it as background? You have the one called Federal and State Flexibility. You talk about that, and is it my impression that the only thing you literally might need statutory authority for, I mean, you may want some other kind, but literally what's in the second page of that referring to state flexibility. Can you just give us that as background as well?
Chair Freeman, Co-Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, the document that Representative Greenlee's referring to is we had looked at both and tried to really detail what we would need in terms of approvals from the federal government and what we would need in terms of state statute. In terms of state statute, it's really three things that we would need. One, statute that really codified the delivery system changes that we were making. And in essence, that would be changing what has been the delivery model in statute, which has been prepaid managed health care, to these coordinated care organizations. That's number one. Number two, we would need clear statutory direction from the legislature to care for both those on Medicare and Medicaid. That would be necessary primarily from a federal perspective that would be looking for the clear state direction in legislation to do that. And the third were a few operational components that, you know, we had talked about, which were addressing some of the state law barriers to sharing information, particularly between mental health and physical health. Those would be needed. We, as I think you know, have been working on some regulatory streamlining issues that we're going to be giving to Representative Freeman and Representative Hoyle in the next day or two, that some of that may require some statutory change, and a requirement around the measurements of quality of care, outcome, and informed decision making. So it's a limited set of statutory requirements that would be necessary. Most of the rest of what is in the legislative approach, so to speak, could be carried out through administrative rule.
Heavy on the could be.
Correct.
All right. Any other questions? Dr. Bates.
Thank you. Bruce, I'm going to direct this to you, I think. I'm not sure if you have talked about Section 16 in this.
We didn't just now, but happy to.
I stepped out for a moment, I'm sorry. One of the key issues here is going to be giving the Oregon Health Authority the authority and the power to execute contracts and do it by rule. And I just want to point out to this committee that's something we want to look at very carefully, very thoughtfully. This has to be a joint effort by those organizations that might step up and say, we want to do this, what they look like, who they are, and what their capabilities are. I'm most concerned about their capabilities. We don't have time to form brand new organizations out there that have the ability to handle billing procedures, to track claims, that have networks set up and ready to go, have arrangements already with either hospitals or other organizations, plus step forward and do further contracting with other groups. So for me, this is a very key area. I'm a little anxious about the rules that might be coming forth from this, and something we should have a full discussion by this committee on. I appreciate it.
Chair Freeman, Senator Bates, members of the committee, indeed, I think you're getting at two of the most important pieces. One is in creating these new organizations, we're going to need to have organizations that step forward that can demonstrate competency. And I think that's what you're getting at, and that in any RFP proposal or anything of that sort, you know, the onus is going to be for organizations to be able to come forward and demonstrate in real and tangible ways that they can meet a variety of requirements and deliver on those and show a clear, thoughtful plan and provide the evidence of their ability to do that. Likewise, there's the other piece of this, which you were getting at, which is what will those requirements be? And how will that process work? And certainly, I think Mike alluded to this as well as the governor, that, you know, our notion of establishing these is to do this in a public and transparent manner, to a way that gathers input from a variety of individuals, and I think thirdly that provides some opportunity for the legislature to feel comfortable in what those criteria are. I think how we do that and how that's designated in statute is, I think, going to be much of the work that you'll have to do over the next month.
just so everybody kind of knows what our timeline is, there's actually several pieces of legislation that have been taken to LC. The committee is expecting to get a piece back the end of this week, the beginning of next week, to actually have a bill for us to start having a real discussion about it. And I appreciate that, you know, tonight we didn't have that ready, so we're having the discussion about, you know, the proposal that's in front of us. But the sooner we can actually get a bill to start marking up and altering and having a discussion about, the better for us. So we're hoping to have that as early as the end of this week, but it could possibly be the beginning of next week. So I saw some more questions down here. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Bates brought up a good section that hadn't been mentioned, and I think that's appropriate, but I would suggest, as we work through the exchange bill, there were lots of concerns and lots of things that clearly are still yet to be defined. We were worried about potentially setting up a system where there could be winners and losers, among other things like that. And so what we ended up doing was saying, go build a business plan, bring it back to us, and we will approve it. And the conversation, and there are, I'm still not comfortable potentially with what a CCO is going to be. I mean, we got a lot more work to do on things like that. But in your conversation, you basically said you're going to do this and then we'll check off on it. And I would suggest it probably will be end up being similar to what we did with the exchanges, having a business plan come back to Legislative Assembly for affirmative action.
Chair Freeman and Senator Cruz, members of the committee, we've been talking about that. I think I've been really referring to it perhaps as an implementation plan and a business plan, how we would do this. And that's exactly it.
Co-Chair Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. I would really urge us to take a minimalist approach, and I think it's very much what Senator Cruz was saying. I think we need two things, and it could be in one bill or it could be two. I think we need a sort of hand them a mandate to do something. I mean, I expect they could go off and do some things, but I think we need a piece that says, here's what ought to happen. They ought to produce A, B, and C. Again, with not much detail, but essentially to share ownership in where they're going with the process. And then I think we need, I would say, a very minimalist set of things we need based on those statutes that they're talking about. And I think one of the things we ought to be hearing very quickly is exactly which statutes do you need to change on those pages, and how do you need them to be changed. So, I mean, I think that should be very simple and straightforward. The creating the handoff to them, that may be a little more complex, but I would urge us not to get involved because of the 6-week thing in any discussions we don't need to be involved in. I mean, and we ought to try and get and have a checkoff downstream. I think both those things are very important.
Is there any other further questions of this panel? Thank you, guys. What I'd like to do now is to have each of the members spend a couple minutes describing what they think healthcare transformation is. We've all sat through the Wednesday night meetings and have had a chance to hear from others what they think. It'd be important for me to hear what the members think, and I'd like to have the co-chairs finish. So we'll start again on the Senate side. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Representative Freeman, one of the co-chairs. I think, you know, if we're going to make this work, we have to have a large focus on keeping people out of the emergency department. And I see in my community, that's where we come up short, where we don't have the access that we should to primary care. And if we do, there's not an urgent care clinic that's accessible to the people in my community, so that the emergency room becomes the de facto urgent care, and often the de facto primary care, when nobody can find a primary care provider that will actually see them in a time frame that's reasonable. So I think that's where I'd like to see us focus, is you know, what's the emergency department need? Is if we bring that down in a way that makes people healthier.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
I think when I read this bill, it's like the more I read, the more questions I have, and I need answers to those questions. I'm a little concerned, like Representative Greenlick said, how fast we go into this. Senator Bates talked about organizations that are ready to go now, which is prejudicing the system to a degree. I don't want to see us setting up a scenario where a community-based system, because it doesn't meet criteria, isn't qualified. And there's a lot of concerns. I look at a lot of the rural parts of the state, not necessarily the metro area. A lot of this stuff is very troubling to me still at this point in time. I think Representative Greenlick talked about what statutory changes we need. That would be good to know. But in my mind, there's a lot more definition needs to be put into what these things that are in here are talking about. I've already got a lot of marker on a lot of this stuff and with a lot of questions. I don't want to be driven by a short time frame to do something. I don't believe in change for change's sake. If the change we make isn't a positive change, we shouldn't be doing it. So I'm personally not going to be driven by trying to rush to a judgment here. I think we need to take whatever time we need. We are at the will of the chairs, and if they want to hold additional meetings, we can do that. So my hope is that we take the time necessary to do this right. I think this bill needs an intense amount of work, similar to what we did on the exchange bill, and I hope we have the time to do that.
Thank you. To the extent we can talk about what we think the transformation will be, let's try to keep focused on that. And with that, Senator Bates.
Well, I think you asked where I see transformation being, and you don't have an hour and a half.
So, I said 3 to 5 minutes, yeah. Please.
Mm-hmm. So I'll try to condense it. We have a healthcare system that is too expensive, as everyone knows, and doesn't produce the outcomes we need. I won't go into the statistics on it. The basic problem in our healthcare system, I believe, are two, possibly three. First one is we don't have enough primary and preventative care. That is the key problem in our system. We don't like to admit that. You go to any other system in the world, and you'll see about 60 to 70% of the providers, be they nurse practitioners, physicians, or others, are in primary care and preventative care, and 30% are specialty care. We are the opposite in this country, and we are driving ourselves in the wrong direction under the healthcare system we have, a fee-for-service for very expensive specialty care at end-of-disease treatment, primarily in hospitals. We will go off a cliff if we keep doing this. So a transformation for me is that kind of a change, going to a primary care preventive system that really makes sense and starts to work. That's not going to happen in the next 5 weeks, but we can lay the groundwork for it. The second issue, again, goes back to global budgets. We have uncontrolled costs in healthcare, frankly, primarily being driven by hospital costs. That has to be brought under control. And the third thing, which nobody wants to talk about, is defensive medicine and medical malpractice, which is outside the work of this committee, which will have to be carried on other parts of the legislature. So that's my bottom line on it. Hope it's clear. And I know we're not going to get there in 5 weeks, Senator Cruz, but we'll get a good start at it.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the vision would be that we create this coordinated care concept. We do it at $300 million at least, less cost. And we do that all in the planning of 6 months and implementation in 12. That we have truly an integration between the public and private for public health, behavioral health, and the private side, again for public for health and behavioral medical issues and behavioral I also raised the issue that Senator Bates raised with respect to putting this in the global budget and telling the providers, this is all you have, now you've got to make informed choices. And to do that in the context of unlimited risk, I think it is within the purview of this bill to consider a provision for medical liability in some way that allows providers to make informed decisions without unlimited risk. Mm-hmm. And so I raise that issue. I know it's a very controversial issue, but as I stated in our transformation team, you know, to go down this road and capping in managed care under the tort system that we have, I think is irresponsible on our part. And I would like to have some discussions about how that might be integrated into this for the delivery of health and these services.
Great. I'll get back to you when we finish. We'll do the co-chair's last. Representative Thompson.
Well, I think we have an unusual problem in front of us because we're having to transform something at a time that we're going to have to reduce the spend radically. And Senator Morris and I have been back and forth on the numbers. He thinks $300 million. I think it's closer to $1 billion we have to reduce, and I hope he's right. But it's going to be a very large number that we have to realize starting in this biennium. And I think we're going to get that only if we're willing to organically transform health care at the community level, especially in the rural parts of the state. If we give the challenge to communities, counties, whatever, to work with the plan and develop a way to deliver services, integrated, really integrated services across a broad spectrum of providers at the local level, they'll figure out how to do it. I would caution, if we go into this with this is going to be some kind of an umbrella, we're going to drop on rural areas, you're going to see resistance like you've never seen before. They're not going to take it from government. We have to have a buy-in at the local level. We have to do a thorough inventory of what's available in each region that we can call upon and get out of the everything has to be physician-centered. To open this thing up. A lot of the rural areas have fairly well-developed parish nurse programs. That's got to be brought in. I was in a discussion the other day about better utilizing emergency medical services. We always tie those to fire trucks. Why is that? We recognize them as being critical for immediate care in emergency situations. Why don't we bring them into the healthcare system and find a better way to utilize those resources? But I don't think in a lot of parts of the state we even know what the resources are on the ground by a geographic division that we can call upon, and they're certainly wildly different between rural Oregon and urban metropolitan Oregon, and that's going to make a difference in how we call people to the table to get this job done. But I think we have to go the community-centered route. And I agree totally with my colleagues. We have to write in malpractice into this thing as much as we can, and then we can write in an expectation that we will change the culture of defensive medicine in reward or in response for the malpractice piece. You're not going to get medical practitioners to change that culture of protective or defensive medicine if there's nothing in there for them. It has to be there.
Great, thank you. Representative
Kotek. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree more with Representative Thompson. You know, if we have, if we parachute into certain parts of the state and then expect them to accept everything with open arms, it won't work. I do think the community-centered aspect of this is absolutely critical. I guess the three things that I'm most interested in the concept, and they've already been mentioned to some degree, is the global budget. Making sure that we can be more creative and innovative, even more than we already are. I think my frustration over the years when we talk about managed care, we assume we had a lot of flexibility, and we actually didn't as much as we wanted to have. And so I think a global budget's going to get us there. And I think we have to be open to looking at that differently and using different types of providers and really maximizing aspects of the community that I think have been restricted in a capitated model. I think the aspect of metrics and what we measure is going to be very important, measuring for outcomes and all the different types of care that will be included here. Not just things that we know about, keeping people out of emergency departments, although I completely agree from a physical health perspective, absolutely critical, but how do we have good metrics in terms of access to care? How do we have good metrics around our behavioral health issues so we know we're actually making progress? And accountability, and I think it's outlined here in the straw proposal from Wednesday night, financial accountability, community accountability, and individual accountability and participation in their CCO. So I think we have a lot of opportunity here, and that's what I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you. Co-Chair Greenlee.
Thank you. I do have a couple things to say. We have to guard against delusions of competence. I published my first article in healthcare 50 years ago this month, and I've been looking over a couple other articles that I've written over the past 50 years, thinking about turning it into a book, and it came to me, I haven't found the answer. I mean, I'm not even sure I found the question in thinking and writing about this in 50 years. We have 6 weeks. If we think we're going to recreate healthcare in deep detail in the next 6 weeks and turn it into a statute nonetheless, I mean, I think we're headed for a fall. And I'll get back to that in a minute. I think we have a couple of key questions. One question is, what's the nature of a CCO? That matters because there are two options I see. One is we can be talking about MCOs on steroids. So we've got MCOs around. They know how to do something. We juice them up a bit. They're going to give us a solution. And at least in the interim, start along a path, because we are going to be starting along a path. The other is the notion that CCO is some brand new kind of community organization that can create itself between now and the issuance of an RFP and be a whole different. And in those new organizations, recreate medical care in some magic way where everybody works together. We switch everything to primary care. All the surgeons disappear off into the trail going off to Aruba on retirement because we've moved everything into primary care and solved the problems of chronic illness. And old folks like me with four diseases will get managed perfectly, so we won't end up in the hospital again, and it's going to be marvelous. And that's going to happen in something we create in a bill over the next 6 weeks. I think the second question is, who's at risk? Bruce and I had this conversation and said, well, we need to build lots of financial reporting in so somebody won't run out of money at the end of 6 months and say, oh, we're going to go bankrupt. Well, no, it can't. We need to say to somebody, you have a contract, you're at risk, you produce those services in length of that contract, and who's the deep pocket? I mean, it could be us as individuals. We could get behind one and sponsor, but I don't think that's likely. So, I mean, who is it? And if you're going to take a risk, do you need not to have the responsibility for how to manage things? And do you want to say, oh, it's no problem, I'll let a bunch of community people that don't know much about healthcare organize it, and I'll pay the bill at the end of the year? No, I don't think it's going to work that way. So the question of risk becomes very important. The question of a single bucket of funds, a global budget, is very important. And the question is, what's in that budget, in that bucket, and how does it affect other people? OHP dollars go in the bucket. I think we have no question about that. Although, how do the OHP dollars come out of the fee-for-service side of OHP and go into that bucket is an interesting question. It's not a big problem. It only represents 40% of all the dollars. So it seems to me we may need to think about what happens, how that 40% gets into this bucket. But how about other things? How about the family planning block grant? Because aren't these CCOs going to be providing family planning services? And does that come into the bucket? What about the mental health block grants that go to the safety net that aren't necessarily going to be covered by this? Does that go into the bucket? I mean, it seems to me these are questions that we need to answer. We probably get that by next week, and we can hear a clear understanding of that. But are we going to be doing things by putting things in the bucket that takes away other things we need in the community, like the safety net in the community? And then there's the whole question of the time frame. This time frame, this pictures an RFP date, and people will apply, and then we'll issue contracts. And on July of 2012, everybody will be in the system, and we're all set to go. Well, I'm not sure that's the right model. I think, to go back to my very first point about not having a magic wand that knows the right way, I think we need a model that allows lots of flowers to bloom, 1,000 flowers to bloom along the way. And that would mean not exactly an RFP process, but a process that says, y'all come and tell us how you're going to do it. And when we're convinced you can do it, we'll give you a contract. Until then, we'll keep doing things the way we're doing it now, with the hope that we can stimulate with technical assistance enough help so that we can get a bunch of people who eventually come in. And it should look very different in Medford than it's going to look in the heart of Multnomah County, and very different in Pendleton than it's going to look in Bend. And we need to be prepared to not be too rigid about what it is we're looking at. And I think we need to create a model that has lots of flexibility in it, that doesn't prejudge what's the right answer, because I don't think we know the right answer. So part of that question is, how do we create this model that will allow 1,000 flowers to bloom along the way? That will give us the kind of learning enterprises that Tina was talking about, so we can find out what they've learned in Pendleton that can help in Bend, and what's failed in Bend that can teach us something about Multnomah County. And I mean, it seems to me we have to have a very minimalist approach to what we try and impose on this model. We've had lots of great ideas. We've had lots of great, you know, anything that's lacking is a bunch of good college fraternity bull sessions about this. But we've had that writ large, and now we need to be able to take advantage of creativity, to foster creativity, and to provide ways that the state can really allow great ideas, however weird they might seem to us right now, move forward and see how they work. So that's what I think our task is. Should be an interesting task.
Well put.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. Co-Chair Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Freeman. I love saying co-chair. Transformation to me is actually transforming the broken healthcare system that we have now. And that means making our healthcare system sustainable in the delivery of care. And I think starting with the Medicaid and dual eligibles is the right place to start. So I don't want to really repeat what everyone else says about budget, but sustainability and cost containment is just huge for me, and I would hope that that is a big part of what's going to come out of this transformation committee. And then, of course, putting my public health hat on, we have to take a holistic approach to delivery of care, and I think others have alluded to it, prevention, and allowing innovative ways to deal with health care delivery, and I think others have already mentioned that. We really need to base our delivery of care on evidence-based practices, and that will have deliverables of really good outcomes. And that, to me, is transformation in a nutshell. And if we can accomplish that, it's going to be good for Oregonians. It's going to be good for our healthcare delivery. It's going to be good for providers. That's what I think.
Thank you. So I probably have maybe the most unique perspective on this, and that I'm probably the newest one up here to deal with healthcare. And as I sat through our Wednesday night meetings, trying to listen and learn what was going on, I rather quickly realized that we got some incredible things going on in the state of Oregon. We've been very innovative in many different ways. And it's super easy to pick apart those things that aren't working perfect. And it's much more difficult to want to focus on those things we're doing very well. So as I heard examples of coordination throughout the state, and everything from the way the dental plans work, the way the some of the current NCOs work with mental health, the way that some of the hospitals deal with some of the elder situations, it came to me that really what's going on here is not a transformation or ruining everything that we have and starting over, but really it's coordinating in a better way. It's taking all those great things we do around the state of Oregon and figuring out a way to coordinate them in such a way that the outcome for patients will be better. And I get that there is a huge, huge budget issue here to deal with. That being said, let's not forget the goal of providing health care to citizens. If nothing we do here makes better health care and healthier people in Oregon, we haven't done the right thing. And if we get through this process and we haven't saved a dime, but we've figured out a way to provide better health care, we have succeeded. Now, that being said, I know, and I happen to agree that the number is $1 billion, so I know we have a huge hole to try to fill with, at least in part, with this transformation or with this coordination. Global budgets. So that's the new buzzword, global budget. It dawned on me rather quickly when I was handed a number from the co-chairs and said, okay, figure out how to fund all this. We do global budgets now. The difference is now the global budget's done in the little room downstairs where we pick winners and losers, and we funnel that money out into our communities, oftentimes with very little consideration for the best way they could use that money. And I don't believe that there's anybody out there that's not doing the very best they can with the money they have, but I also believe there's a way to help coordinate the way those dollars are spent. And in my mind, what a coordinated care organization is a community-owned, community-operated organization. And when I say community-owned, I mean the entire community that lives there. Those people, of course, that are going to provide the service, those people that are going to take the risk, but more importantly, those people that need the health care. That's your community. And to the extent we can figure out a way to allow enough flexibility to let communities be innovative and figure this out, it will be the success of it. And our challenge is to do it in a way that is restrictive enough that we as legislators can feel comfortable with what we're doing and that we're going to be accountable to the taxpayers that send us up here, but allow it to be open enough and flexible enough to allow communities to be innovative. And that really, in my mind, is our challenge. So I know there's people here that have a ton more experience than me at this. I look forward to listening and learning and continuing to try to help figure this out. I happen to know there is not only the people in this room, but an overflow D and around the state of Oregon that are sitting on their edge of the chair wondering what it is we're doing and how it is we're going to get this done so quickly. But I also know, having sat here through a series of public testimonies, we have a lot of people out there that have some extreme needs, and we have to do this. We have to figure this out. And it's incumbent upon us to do everything we can. That being said, if we don't get there and we've done the best we can, I'll feel comfortable with that we've done everything possible to make this happen. So, with that being said, we have a few minutes if there's any further comments of the panel up here.
We're an efficient group.
Well, sense is this will be our only quick night as we get draft legislation put together and start getting under this extreme timeline. So that being said,
judge our efficiency by how quick we got the rules adopted.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring that up, Senator Cruz, but we did get through that. The committee will meet next Wednesday, April 13th at 5:30 p.m. In this hearing room. And I do.
Senator Monis Anderson in command.
Senator Monis Anderson will be chairing the committee, and I am very much looking forward to working with my co-chairs and the rest of this committee. With that, the meeting's adjourned.
Good work.